You are listening to the Tricorder Transmissions, Episode 8. And
now,
here are
Craig
and
Jeff.
This week's episode of the Tricorder Transmissions. As always, I'm your host, Jeff.
And I'm Craig, and we on episode 8, we are talking about Miri.
Yeah, so last week in our intro, before we got started, we were talking a little bit about Into Darkness, and Craig had just gotten it on his way home from work out of the Redbox machine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I just happened to spy an article earlier today that mentioned that the Blu-ray and DVD releases of Into Darkness are selling well. So that kind of segues us right back into where we were last week. So you got a chance to watch it?
Yes, I did. And real quick, I wonder how many of those sales are hardcore fans buying multiple copies so they could get all the extras. but I digress. I did watch it again.
Good.
And pretty much like my first viewing, the movie plays really well up until a certain point for me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'd say if the movie ended 20 minutes earlier than it did, I would rank it as a really, really, really strong entry in the Star Trek movie franchise. But man, does that last 20 minutes or so really sour me on the movie.
Wow, really? Okay. That's understandable. I think I know where you're going with that. I almost sort of feel the same way, but I'm a little more tolerant.
Yeah.
Of the last portion. So you're talking about the portion where Spock and Khan are fighting on the hover cars and all of that type of
stuff. Yeah, I mean, the whole section, that whole last section just feels incredibly rushed. At home, looking at the counter on my Blu-ray player and seeing how many minutes were left in the movie, I'm like, wow, they still got a lot to do. And they do it really quick. It feels like they were like, oh, crap, we have a lot to finish here and we got to keep it under X amount of minutes. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I kind of agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
So like I said, I think I'm a little more tolerant of that sequence. I do agree with you about, I mean, we had a little more of an in-depth conversation earlier mm-hmm. in the week about the whole hover cars thing anyway.
Yeah.
And we definitely are on the same page with that. I think that was kind of thrown in as a way to enhance the action to make it seem like there was more at stake or that it was a more difficult fight to have. But
yeah,
I don't think it was necessary. I think it would have been just as effective, if not more effective, if they fought somewhere maybe in the bowels of the Enterprise, kind of like Kirk and Khan did in Space Seed in engineering, maybe, where there's all
sure,
sorts of
yeah.
pipes and computer apparatuses and things all around. It might have looked kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I mean, there were some cool things in that sequence. You know, Spock trying to use the nerve pinch on Khan and it not really working to its full effect. But I think the thing was, you know, when they sort of took the story turn that they did. And, you know, I want to try and stay a little bit spoiler free here for people who haven't seen it yet. But, you know, if you look at the end of Wrath of Khan and to Search for Spock, there were a couple years there, you know, where fans were sort of in limbo wondering what the F was going to happen next with the movie series. And here it seemed like, oh, well, audiences can't wait for sequels anymore more than 6 months, you know. And since we didn't film a movie right, you know, at the same time as this one, we can't make people wait. You know, imagine mm-hmm, if people had to wait between Empire and Return of the Jedi today.
Yeah, I know. You know, this reminds me so much of a recent interview I read with the now cult internet famous Joss Whedon.
Okay.
Where he was saying something to the effect of movies, in his estimation, movies have to be able to live in a self-contained way where they have to wrap.
Mm-hmm.
in a way that doesn't leave you hanging for a sequel, which I completely disagree with. I thought that, and I had this conversation with my uncle, who is a big Star Trek fan, and I saw all the movies with when I was a kid, and he distinctly remembers the feeling that he left the theater with after seeing The Wrath of Khan and just being in complete disbelief that they killed Spock.
Yeah, but I mean, that movie does have a concrete ending. I mean, if you watch The Wrath of Khan and never watched another Star Trek movie, you know, I mean, yeah, sure, you get the reveal of the his coffin or his torpedo or whatever on the Genesis planet. But if the world ended the next day, I think a lot of people would have been like, you know what, you know, that movie was pretty entertaining. With Empire, Han's frozen in carbonite. There's really no closure to that movie. There's the promise of Jedi, you know. And I think with like the end of Wrath of Khan, I mean, I don't remember at that time, but I mean, I don't know if there was a promise of a third movie.
Well, there was an implied promise of a third movie, because after Spock's death and the torpedo shown, you hear Spock reading the captain's monologue of the space, the final frontier, implying that the adventure is going to continue on after this. So you did get, you could come out of that with an expectation of, okay, this is another kind of the reset press after the kind of disaster that was the motion picture, the rebooting, as it were, back then, starting over again, and we're going to see more of the adventures of the Enterprise with or without Spock. Yeah. So we didn't know at the time what was going to happen. And I kind of disagree a little bit with the comparison with The Empire Strikes Back, because the way The Empire Strikes Back ended, sure, Han's frozen in carbonite, whatnot, and Luke lost his hand, but you do see Luke and Leia and the droids. They're safe. Mm-hmm. They're on the Armada. They're hanging out. They're looking out the window. They kind of have that embrace at the end. That could have been an end. If they didn't have another movie after that, it could have stood on its own that way. Like, wow, that really sucks. So the Rebels made out well in the first one, and the Empire kicked their ass in the second one, and now everybody's even, right?
Yeah, but can you imagine how angry the internet would be if there was no Return of the Jedi to follow up Empire?
The internet is angry no matter what happens. So to hell with the internet.
Yeah, yeah. So, I kind of get what you're saying in the sense that I don't feel that that filmmakers owe the fans anything when it comes to telling even a complete story. I think there's, a lot of, artsy films out there or whatever that are very, very open to interpretation.
Absolutely.
I think when you start making big budget filmmaking, that's the point where you probably have to start thinking of satisfying an audience, because ultimately a studio is giving you a lot of money to make a movie in the hopes that you're going to get a return on that investment.
I get, yeah, that's true in a way. The movie industry is very different today than it used to be. But rolling back into darkness, let's kind of roll back in again. Mm-hmm. So now I was reading also earlier in the week that there is a deleted scene that, of course, did not make it onto the any of the releases that came out.
Yeah, they'll wait for the super duper release next year.
Supposedly there was a scene that was either scripted or shot, one of the two, where at the end, after Kirk is resurrected, I don't care about spoilers, the movie's been out for a long time. If you haven't seen it and you're listening to this podcast, you're not a real Star Trek fan if you haven't seen it for a long time. So there's supposed to be a scene that fits in at the end where Kirk meets the mother of the young girl that Khan saved in the beginning of the movie to convince her father to blow up that base, right? And supposedly Kirk is supposed to have some sort of a tacit connection or recognition, a look of recognition when he sees this kid as they share Khan's blood, right?
Yeah, yeah, they're both super beings.
Yeah, I'm glad that wasn't in the movie.
Yeah, you know what? I almost feel like we didn't even need that whole plot to be shown in the movie. Mm-hmm. We ultimately learn that Khan's blood is able to regenerate things with the whole Tribble experiment.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, you could argue that, you know, the little girl at the beginning was sort of a way to say, hey, at the end, this is going to come into play. But they already pointed out with the Tribbles. So for me, it was just like, this is sort of J.J. Abrams adding an element to it to appeal to that outside audience. I know when they were making the reboot, there was a big concern about making sure that, you know, a guy could take his girlfriend to the movie.
Yep.
And if she wasn't a Star Trek fan, she'd be on board. And that's what that whole sort of plot felt like to me. And, you know, that was one of the only really parts of that movie that didn't feel like Star Trek to me. I mean, we have that awesome opening sequence where they're on that that planet with the volcano.
Yeah, it was almost a Bond style opening.
It was, yeah. You know, I mean, it kind of does drive the plot a little bit in a sense that it sets up Kirk to, you know, to be reprimanded or whatever. And getting past the whole prime directive discussion that didn't seem to make sense, and I'm sure we'll talk about when we do a full Into Darkness episode. It seems like when you cut from that to the guy and his wife going to visit the girl in the hospital, and then Khan coming out and saying, I can help you, and pretty much being in on the fact that this guy was going to betray Starfleet, to me it just didn't feel like I needed that.
Yeah,
you know, I'm not going to say it affected my enjoyment of the movie one way or the other.
Yep.
But it just felt like if I'm trying to really make this movie leaner and also a perfect movie for the Star Trek audience, that's something I would lose.
Well, I think we're going to hold on to the rest of this for when we do the actual In the Darkness discussion. But I think during the week when we were talking about this a little bit, I think we did a really good rewrite of the movie over IM. So let's take that and save that for later, because I think the way we rewrote it in a hasty 15 minutes would have made it a 10 times better film.
Yes.
So let's hold up. But I'll wrap this part of the discussion by saying that seeing Into Darkness on Blu-ray for the second time, which was the first time I saw it in the theater, my second time seeing it was on the Blu-ray, I came out of my second viewing with the exact same impression that I had from my viewing in the theater. So my opinion of the movie overall hasn't changed with my second viewing. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, I pretty much came away, I might have felt a little bit better about it. I'm actually going to say I did feel better about it. I wouldn't rank it any higher or lower than I did when we ranked the movies. But I think there is a lot of good in it. But like I said, man, that last 20 minutes just really,
that's tough.
It really takes the movie down a notch.
Yeah, I understood. So we have a couple of other news items that we can go over if you want.
Sure. Yeah.
I'll save the best one for last. So the next one is in September, IDW is publishing some Star Trek comics. So some, I guess, trade paperback-ish type things. One's called Star Trek The Best of the Klingons and Star Trek The Newspaper Strips Volume 2. So there's some older newspaper, Sunday newspaper clips from Star Trek back from the early 80s that they're going to be publishing that I've never seen, frankly.
No, neither have I.
So
that's
I may actually pick this up. It looks really nice. The drawing that I've seen in a couple sample pages looks really nice. Looks nicely done. Let's see. It's $24.99 gets you a 234-page issue. Which
that's got to be a ton of strips though, because you're probably fitting at least four per page, if not six or eight. And the cool thing about reading those Sunday strips all collected together is you don't have to wait a week to continue the story.
Oh, that was the price of that was for the Klingon series. The price, it's $50, $49.99 for the 232-page newspaper strips volume 2, which encompasses strips that ran from October 26, 81 through December 3rd of 83.
Wow, so that's what, like 2 years worth.
Yeah.
That's going to be what, over what, like a 100 and some odd? Wow.
Yeah, looks really nice. I'm seriously considering. Might be on my Christmas list.
Yeah. That's a lot of coin for a book, but
it looks really nice. It looks like they've done a really good job with it. So I'm definitely going to keep that on my watch list.
Ah, cool.
And the other news item, which is I think is great. I've actually already watched this and it's fantastic. It's as good as you would think it would be.
Oh, okay.
So, the beloved George Takei is now involved in a new AARP YouTube show.
That's great.
It's a biweekly series under the name of Takei's Take, and it is George talking about technology from the perspective of senior citizens.
Oh, that is excellent. I know you told me about this earlier. I am going to fire this up as soon as we are done recording today.
I'm telling you, will love this. The first episode, which is out now, is concerning Google Glass. Mm-hmm. So George himself gets to try on some Google Glass. So you get to see him play with that. And it has all of what you'd expect. If you've been following any of George Takei's Twitter posts or any of his interviews that he's done in the last few years, you know what he's like. Mm-hmm. And this, he takes full advantage of his personality in these videos. You know, you get some oh my's in there.
Yeah, awesome.
And you get some of the typical jokes that he makes and his facial expression. It's an absolute delight to watch. And I've subscribed to the YouTube channel because I don't want to miss any of these.
Excellent. How long do they run?
Not very long. Uh-huh. Not very long at all. Let me see. I'll take a look and see what the first episode was. I think it's about 5 minutes or so.
Okay.
A little under 5 minutes. Yeah. So they're not really long, but it's long enough for you to get a good amount of enjoyment out of watching George. Yeah.
Very cool.
Definitely worth a watch. So that is about it for news for this week. Do you have anything you want to talk about?
I would love to find something to talk about before we sit down and watch Miri.
Yeah, anything to delay that, huh?
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll save that, of course, for during and after the episode. We don't want to. We may have already tipped our cards a little on this one.
All right. But, so, we have some. So, I guess some of the technical information for this episode.
Yep, I got some air dates for you if you've got the description.
I do.
All right, so original air date October 27th of 1966 and remaster on September 16th of 2006.
All right, cool. And an episode rundown. The Enterprise discovers an Earth-like planet that was devastated by a horrific degenerative disease and is now populated entirely by impossibly old children. Sounds very exciting.
It certainly does, and I am enthusiastic to get into this episode, as I assume you are.
Yeah, so let's get to it.
Okay, all right. We are going to start this episode for you people listening in our audience in 3, 2, and 1.
So, as always, we see the Star Trek Enterprise traveling through space. Is there a Star Trek episode that starts without that establishing shot of the Enterprise in space?
Off the top of my head, yeah. I'm not sure how to answer that question.
Yeah, that's something that we're going to have to
keep
track of.
And right near the beginning, we see the old beehive hairdo, our old friend Janice Rand.
Yes, and I'll have a little tidbit about the hair later on in the episode, which I found a nice little quote about.
Nice.
So it looks like they are approaching planet Earth.
Oh, boy.
One of the funniest things here is Spock starts detailing the weight and the other scientific aspects of Earth. And everybody immediately knows that it's Earth based on, you know, the 10.2 to the 10th power or whatever Spock explains. Even Yeoman Rand knows that that's Earth.
Yeah.
But I guess looking at it in the viewfinder, it looks like
Africa
Earth.
Going by.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, and I've said this before, and there's the United States, by the way, or the North American continent. So I've said this before, and we're going to see this time and time again. How many Earth-like planets we're going to come across in the original series. But one interesting fact about this episode is that this is the first episode since the original pilot, to feature outdoor shooting.
Okay, yeah.
Yep, and they're going to be doing outdoor shooting on redressed Andy Griffith sets.
Yes, which was another show that was Desilu production.
Yep.
So there was, I guess, a family...
Popular at the time, too. Yes. Popular at the time.
A family relation there.
I must say I've watched some of the Andy Griffith Show in my day, and it had its charm.
Yeah. Yeah, it put a lot of people on the map, you know.
It certainly did. And I'll tell you, I've also watched more than my fair share of Matlock. So, Mr. Griffith, hats off to you for giving me this seemingly endless supply of entertainment. But anyway, back to Star Trek.
Yes.
Another really fun fact about this episode is that this episode was broadcast by the BBC for the first time in December of 1970.
So that's a couple years later, four years or so, a little more
since it came out. And it was shelved, right? They showed it, and then they were shelved it until the 1990s, along with three other original series episodes, including Empath, Whom the Gods Destroy, and Plato's Stepchildren. These episodes were shelved because they dealt with unpleasant topics such as disease and slavery.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So
so it's a good thing we weren't Star Trek fans living in Britain in 1966,
67. 70, yeah. You may not have seen this episode until the 1990s, potentially, unless you'd... Well, I mean, when did the original VHS tapes come out? Those... I don't think that was in the 80s, was it? I have to look
I don't know.
I'm showing my lack of knowledge on that there.
I would guess it was probably the 1990s, because it doesn't seem like television on home video really exploded
until the
90s. It didn't seem like people thought it was a viable, product. And also, it was also the delivery system was terrible,
really
too. We've talked on this show before about how when it came out on VHS, you would get two episodes on a tape.
Yeah,
and
really
not
the best.
It would cost about $13.
Red shirt.
Yeah.
Another... Just want to look back here at what's going on for a second. So this is another strange oddity, is the landing party includes the captain's yeoman. but the part of the reason for that is that the original draft of the script for this episode called for a very a much closer relationship with Kirk and Rand particular episode. So this was still, I think, at the stage where they were planning to have Kirk and Rand have some sort of an emotional relationship between the two. But the actual writer of this episode, after this episode was done, he was no longer allowed to write for the original series again, because the script, after they had to do a lot of snipping and rewriting, the script itself came up about 10 minutes short.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so they had to, they did some corrective editing, and they had to do some late-stage rewriting for this. So I guess they didn't allow him to write for the original series anymore.
That was a gentleman by the name of Adrian
Spies.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it's pronounced Spies or Spies or something like that, but yeah.
So McCoy was examining a busted-up tricycle when he got attacked by a monster, for lack of a better word, and it was interesting in that sequence that Kirk has to deliver a series of punches when Spock's there, and I was just waiting for Spock to sort of reach down and give him the old nerve pinch.
No such luck.
The person is going into a seizure and will shortly die. What a sad end. Somebody is playing with your broken tricycle.
Yeah.
And it's
heartbreaking for that guy.
It's
that's
a great
how he goes
Kirk
out.
Moment here, because he realizes that you're dealing with somebody with some kind of stunted emotional development, and he comforts him and tells him that they'll fix the tricycle, which I think is a really, really cool little moment.
Yeah, one of few good moments in this episode, but
And I gotta tell you, man, it's so always weird watching a Star Trek episode on location. You know?
Yeah. No, there aren't many of them that are like this. I mean, which other ones do we have?
City on the Edge of Forever.
City on the Edge of Forever.
Shore Leave, I think. That's...
Yeah. And, what's the title of the Kirok episode in season 3? Paradise Syndrome.
Okay.
Paradise Syndrome, I believe. So, this is a lot of old Hollywood backlot here, I guess.
Yeah.
And Spock also identified it as a replica of Earth in the 1960s.
Well, how convenient.
Yes.
How convenient. Yep. A lot of wreckage here. A lot of, looks like a lot of bad stuff has gone down. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, the planet, which is an exact copy or very close to Earth, it will become quite commonplace in this series. And we'll be seeing that all through the first, second, and third seasons. This episode is just one of a long, long list.
Mm-hmm. And this episode is directed by a gentleman named Vincent McEvedy, who retired in the year 2000 after a career that spanned over 40 years. He directed six episodes of the original series, so we're going to be seeing his name a couple more times, including episodes Dagger of the Mind, Balance of Terror, Patterns of Force, and Spectre of the Gun. He also directed for the Untouchables, Gunsmoke, How the West Was Won, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., Murder, She Wrote, nice. Diagnosis Murder, and Magnum P.I.
Wow, so, man, that's a huge body of work right there.
Yeah,
I've watched many of those shows myself.
Yeah, I'd imagine you'd be hard pressed to find yourself with something not to talk about with him if you ran into him at a cocktail party.
Oh, for sure, for sure.
Yeah, it had to be kind of cool to be a TV director in the 60s, much like we've talked about all the guest stars that sort of shared TV appearances. But the directors as well, you know?
Yeah, for sure, yeah. So, back to the scene that we just were watching here, just to point this out, you actually see Spock really using a tricorder. Mm-hmm. So you get to see the inside the little hatch on the front of the tricorder, there were some dials in there. You can also see it on our podcast logo. Where Spock was actually rotating a couple of those dials. You don't see that too often. But it was kind of neat to see him really interacting with the tricorder as a device. So we've discovered an adolescent girl here who's a little bit rattled.
Yeah, it's Kim Darby playing the title character, Miri.
Yeah,
and I actually know Kim from this show, of course, but also a made-for-TV horror movie from the early 70s called Don't Be Afraid of the Dark.
Ooh, I remember that one.
Which I saw for the first time a couple years ago. So I hadn't seen this episode since I had seen Don't Be Afraid of the Dark for the first time. So it was kind of cool being like, hey, there's the girl from Don't Be Afraid of the Dark.
Any other interesting tidbits about her while we're at it?
She's done a ton of work. She was on The Love Boat, The Streets of San Francisco, Riptide, and even more recently, the show Becker. Wow. So,
you know, just to give a shout out to The Love Boat, which was recently scrapped.
Yeah.
Yeah, not long ago. I know that's a little bit a little topical, but, you know, since you mentioned The Love Boat.
Yeah, and it's going to be, melted down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. That's sad. I didn't care for the show. My mother watched it a lot, but I remember it. You know, it's sad to see, you know, the actual ship. But I had no idea that it was actually still being used.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah, it was what, the something princess?
The Pacific Princess, yeah.
I'll tell you, that was a big deal for us on Friday nights when I was a kid.
Really?
The back-to-back Love Boat Fantasy Island.
Oh, my God,
You know, that was something that I looked forward to. And I don't know why.
Deep plane.
You know, The Love Boat definitely wasn't a show that was geared towards kids. The Fantasy Island, I think, kind of was. You
and
know,
Fantasy Island has a little Star Trek tie, of course.
Yeah. But, So,
all right. Let's see. So, getting back to the episode, I'm sorry I diverted us to The Love Boat there for a couple of minutes.
A quick away mission.
Yeah, a little quick away mission. So, off to a little bit of a slower start here. So, we're learning a little bit about what's been going on in the... The adults all went buck nuts and were tearing each other apart and chasing the kids around and making things relatively unpleasant. And so Spock and two red shirts are kind of doing some recon here, trying to get a little bit of an idea of what's been going on.
Mm-hmm. And the red shirts, they make it through the episode.
I believe they do. I believe they do. I haven't seen this one. I mean, I watched this a couple of months ago, right when I first picked up the Blu-rays.
Yeah.
And I hadn't seen it in quite a while. And it might have been my first time watching the remastered version of this.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something up on top of the building. So I think we're going to find out that it's the group of kids who are evading the Enterprise away party, I guess, because they're adults and the kids are afraid that sure. they're going to go nuts. And
this has to be the ultimate sort of place to play hide and seek.
Oh, you would think.
You know, I mean,
look at these fire escapes, mm-hmm. and look at that move from Spock.
There's a couple of stunt performances in this episode,
yeah,
that you watch and say, if they did this now,
oh.
it would be a stunt double.
Oh, absolutely.
There's even later on, there's a scene where Kirk picks up a kid and almost throws him.
Yeah.
And it's done in one shot, and mm-hmm. it's clearly the kid. And you can't imagine that being allowed today.
No, and the amount of insurance that they would need today, I mean, the litigious times we live in,
mm-hmm.
yeah, no way.
So. This is another episode. It's interesting. Last week we talked about, excuse me, What Are Little Girls Made Of? And we noted that it was an episode that really didn't have a lot of the Enterprise on it.
Yep.
And the following episode, Miri, they're down on the surface,
yep.
and there's very, very little Enterprise play in this episode right. at all.
Yeah, in fact, I think you'll get a little bit when McCoy is looking for extra equipment to be beamed down. Mm-hmm. I think you'll get a little bit then.
Yeah.
But, yeah, otherwise... they're pretty much going to find out that they need to be sequestered away from the ship, so they don't want to bring this disease
yeah.
back up to the ship with them.
Yeah, but you'd also think they'd have some kind of quarantine area on the Enterprise that would be. I guess it wasn't worth risking.
Well, you'd think sick bay itself would probably be a quarantine area. It could beam them directly to sick bay, but maybe they hadn't gotten to the point in the series where they'd written. Those types of things yet. Maybe they hadn't thought of beaming people directly to certain locations. Like you were still kind of tied to beaming into the transporter room.
Mm-hmm. And actually, here's where we're going to get indication that that it's not good to be an adult on this planet, because Kirk's sort of having a moment with Miri here. You know, he's basically really trying to comfort her.
Yeah,
he's
using his people skills.
Yeah, which Kirk has.
Yeah.
The best people skills. He'd probably read How to Win Friends and Influence People a handful of times. It was probably on his bedside.
Yeah. Dale Carnegie is still alive and well via the book.
Yeah. So she notices Kirk has this bluish sort of rash or infection on his hand.
Oops.
And that is a sign to Miri that Kirk is going to eventually go crazy. And
good time for a commercial break.
Yes.
Great fade out there. Mm-hmm. It's a little tension.
Yeah, I also like the fact that Kirk sort of doesn't show... Mm-hmm. He's almost Vulcan-like in his response.
Right, he doesn't panic.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that's his temperament over his time in space and all the stuff that he's seen. And if you were to go in broadcast order like we're doing,
mm-hmm.
he just recently faced another contagious illness... in The Naked Time, which mm-hmm. was only a couple of episodes mm-hmm. ago. So he just pretty much pulled through that one. So maybe he's thinking, well, you know, I just dealt with that. And,
and
this is nothing, man.
Yeah, and I've got my doctor here.
You've got the genius doctor and you've got the genius Vulcan. They're going to figure it out, right? They've got to.
Yeah.
They've got to.
And at this point, they've noticed that, Spock's the only one not affected.
Yeah, another Vulcan advantage of his green blood and his different body chemistry is this doesn't affect him at all. So that's kind of nice. But he is a carrier, though. He is a carrier. The disease won't actually kill him.
Mm-hmm.
But he can spread it to others.
And we got a little sort of... annoyance from McCoy at having to work with antiquated scientific equipment, but not as much as I thought we would. I mean, I guess maybe mm-hmm. he's more focused on saying, hey, I got a serious situation to deal with here. I can't complain about a glass beaker.
Yeah, he's got to make do with what he's got, I think, mm-hmm. at this point, because have they figured out how long they have yet?
I don't think so. I don't think we're at that point yet where they realize they've narrowed it down to a series of days. Mm. I also like the fact that there was the no smoking sign in lab here. I don't know. It amused me for some reason. McCoy is showing signs now. He's got the blue, the blue rash. Yeah. I wonder if anybody's actually done cosplay for this episode.
That's a good question.
Where they've been, you know, they've just been in a standard Starfleet uniform.
And they stuck the blue and
the
red.
The little blue.
Purple stuff.
I'd imagine that somebody's had to have done it. I'd imagine for every episode of Star Trek, much like many other things in this world, for every episode of Star Trek, there's a fan where this is their favorite episode.
More than likely.
So I'd imagine if somebody was going to, you know, dress up and go to a Star Trek convention or something, and this was their favorite episode, they're throwing the blue rash on.
Yeah, more than likely. I want to get some some little makeup there and stick it all over yourself.
But I kind of like the modified toaster that Rand is playing with. It's got the multicolored lights on it. It really looks like they just dressed a toaster, which is awesome. Mm.
Spock a little bit on the annoyed side here. Mm-hmm.
And I think we're at the point in the series now where Spock is pretty much completely Spock.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say he's baked.
Yeah.
Aside from some of the abilities that he gains over the time, we haven't seen a mind meld yet, have we?
No.
So, you know, he gains other abilities over time, but I think as far as his personality is concerned, and you know, the logical, unemotional character, I think he's pretty baked.
Yeah, yeah. And this was a good episode for me in the sense that we saw the core trio.
Yeah, this is the Trinity all working together. So you've got the emotional McCoy, the logical Spock, and the headstrong, aggressive, not necessarily always aggressive, but I'm getting lost in the episode here in this conversation that they're having. I started to drift off.
Yeah. But I think we're also almost reaching a point where we see that Spock is fully baked, as you said.
Yep.
But also, I think we're pretty close to seeing McCoy and Scotty and Sulu every episode.
Yep, you're getting to the point now. Mm-hmm. I think, well, they this is getting towards the tail end of the deep integration of Rand.
Mm-hmm.
So they start to take her out more, and other characters start to get more screen time and more lines and more tangible parts in the stories. So you definitely will start to see some more Sulu for sure, and some more Scotty.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, nothing is more off-putting than seeing the bridge without its classic configuration. You know,
it is weird, isn't it? Yeah, it is a little bit. And this guy, he was in a couple episodes on the bridge, and he's a little bit strange.
Yeah. I'll tell you, one of the things I really like about these remastered episodes are the flyby shots they do with the Enterprise.
Yeah.
Because the Enterprise still looks like the Enterprise. It still looks like the model that they used. It's probably some kind of computer scan or something. But on the original episodes, I guess there were so many special effects elements that they were combining that there were points where the Enterprise would look very soft, very grainy.
Yeah.
So that's one of the really coolest aspects of the remastered episodes for me is, you know, sort of the subtle sort of improvement they made with the flyby shots of the Enterprise.
Yeah. And another thing that we had to keep in mind is that, you and I both, we were alive in the 70s, so we saw syndicated versions of the show, but we did not personally witness the show's original broadcast. So from what I had read, the original broadcast of the show, depending on the market that you were watching it in, it would look vastly different.
Okay.
So, you know, they would, you know, some markets, you know, it would look better. In some markets, they'd have the quality of the signal was going out was not quite as good, or they'd have a second generation copy that they were broadcasting, so it would get muddier and muddier. So when the remasters were done, it was really literally the first time you were seeing this show, you know, quote unquote, as it was intended to look when they filmed it. You could really see, you know, the colors and the richness of the, you know, all the set pieces and the, you know, the way the bridge was designed. It was supposed to really show off color television back then, because that's when they were really pushing color TV. So, you know, seeing it as we're seeing it now is actually kind of a treat. You know, and it didn't look like this, and it didn't even look close to this back then. From what I understand, I heard stories from my uncle, who was a big Star Trek fan back then, and he'd seen the original broadcasts, and he said, this is far and away. Far and away different.
Yeah, and certain people were probably still watching the show on black and white sets as well. So it is definitely a good time to be a Star Trek fan.
Oh, probably one of the best times.
With these remasters.
So, while we're here...
There's a lot of talking in this episode.
Yeah, this is a dialogue-heavy episode. So, let's take a quick look at some of the overall theme and philosophy of this particular episode. So, this episode deals with, you know, bioengineering, if you will. So this turns out to be a like a man-made plague.
Yeah, they're basically trying to find the Fountain of Youth.
Right, and it turns against them and turns into a plague that wipes them out essentially. So, you know, once again, back in the '60s, you know, medical technology is getting better and better and better. You know, biological weaponry, things like that are starting to come into play, or already had been in play, but you know, becoming more controversial. So, you know, this is another example of an original Trek episode that dealt with a topical subject back in those days, and the way that they were able to get around actually talking about what was going on in the world at the time is they wrote a fictional story in a science fiction setting that would deal with that issue. So then this is the kind of a thing that will reoccur and reoccur. It's one of the things that the original series is really famous for. And this is a great example of that in practice.
And Michael Pollard just showed up, who instantly throws you off, because Michael Pollard was, he looks young. He was 27 years old when he was in this episode of Star Trek, and he's supposed to be playing a prepubescent boy. I don't know how confused you were, but I was completely thrown out of the episode as soon as I saw him.
And I think it's because we have seen him in many other things, and I immediately recognized him, and I immediately recognized him as older than all of these kids. So it does take me out of this episode. And to be brutally honest, and I know that this is probably going to raise the ire of some Trek fans out there, but I find that these episodes that feature the children in them, they kind of annoy me. I know it's bad to say, but you know, this episode and what's the other one, and The Children Shall Lead, I just find them, they just take me out of the Star Trek mentality for some reason. And I know that's not the greatest thing to say, and you know, like turning some people off with that, but it really doesn't really work that well for me.
No, it's completely understandable. I remember Michael Pollard most recently from a great sort of cameo he has at the beginning of Rob Zombie's House of a Thousand Corpses.
Oh, wow.
It's the very opening scene of that movie. And it's very cool. He's just sitting there talking to the guy that Captain Spaulding. Very cool scene, and that's what I remember him for. And here we have another monster.
Really a much younger looking monster. So she must have just reached the age where where this would happen to her.
Yeah. Well, this was the other thing that was kind of you know, I didn't do the math on it, but they said they basically engineered this serum or whatever.
Right, to keep it a certain age. Right?
That you would age, what, 1 month every 100 years or something?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
So the math really, like, I tried to think about, like, you know, I mean, feasibly, Miri would still have years and years and years before she was going to hit.
Yeah.
You know.
Well,
you know,
for
puberty.
Plot convenience yeah. purposes, yeah, they just mm-hmm. so happen to arrive right before, and they give her a job of sharpening pencils.
Yeah.
Remember Kirk pencil sharpeners?
Yeah.
They still had pencil sharpeners in the 23rd century.
It's great. He gives her some busy work, sort of, to keep her occupied, which
keep her mind up,
a great little detail. I mean, I think this episode, if it's good for anything, it's kind of good in the sense that it shows that side of Kirk, sort of the
fatherly side, like we saw in Charlie X in a way.
Yeah, he has the ability to relate to children.
He does.
In a way that that's not demeaning.
Yep.
You know, I don't know. It's really cool. I guess it shows or speaks to his natural yeah. ability as a leader.
Yeah, he can shift gears very yeah. well, and you know, based on who he's dealing mm-hmm. with at the given time. So he can go back and forth and being very serious with Spock and McCoy with this disease, and then kind of taking himself down a couple of notches to keep her calm.
Yeah.
And even though his disease is getting worse and he realizes his time is drawing shorter and shorter, he's still able to keep his composure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which as the episode goes on, we see everybody sort of getting a little bit more wound up.
Mm.
So I guess maybe we can talk about the group of kids.
Sure.
It seemed like what they did on this episode was they gathered as many kids from the cast and crew as they can. Shatner's daughters were on set. Roddenberry's kids, the director's kids.
Yep.
And also actor Phil Morris, who a lot of people probably know from playing Jackie Chiles on Seinfeld.
Oh, man, what a great show.
But I did not know this. His dad was on Mission Impossible.
Cool.
And he, Phil Morris, actually was involved for Star Trek for a couple other productions. He was in Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, Deep Space Nine, and on Voyager. So that's kind of something I didn't know. I didn't know that Jackie Chiles was in this episode, and I also didn't recognize him, I guess, out of Jackie Chiles' character in Star Trek III or Deep Space Nine or Voyager, which... When it aired, I watched Voyager for at least half of its run before I sort of fell out with it.
Mm.
But so I may or may not have seen him on the episode.
Oh. Nimoy, interestingly enough, Nimoy refused to bring his children because he didn't want them involved and he didn't want to expose them to show business. So he was asked, mm-hmm. but he opted not to bring his kids.
Yeah, so I have some quotes from Phil Morris. He says, they got me, my older sister, Iona, two of William Shatner's daughters, Vincent McEvity's kids, and more. It was cool, man, working with Michael J. Pollard. And it was a lot of fun until my foot got run over by a camera dolly.
Ow.
Which made it both the highlight and the low light of my career.
Ow, man.
Elizabeth Shatner and her sister Leslie were on set as well. And Elizabeth notes that she was too young to understand why they were doing the things that they were being asked to do, but she eventually realized everything was make-believe or pretend. There is one thing about this episode that sort of amused her, though, was or stayed in her memory, was Rand's unique hairdo.
Yep.
She says, I was utterly fascinated by it. It was woven into a checkered pattern on top, and I stared at it for a long time wondering if it was possible to actually play checkers on it. So.
And you know, so I have something in common with her because I'm fascinated with that hairdo too. I've mentioned, I think every time Rand has been on an episode and we've podcasted about it so far, I always mention the impossible hairdo.
Mm-hmm. So now we sort of see how clever the kids are.
Mm.
They've determined that they need to cut communications to the ship off, or, you know, they're not entirely sure who they're communicating with, but they know that they have these little boxes that they're able to talk to other people with. So conveniently, everybody left their communicators out on the counters for Michael Pollard to come in and grab them.
Pretty amazing, huh?
Which I always thought was interesting because I can't recall another episode where your communicator wasn't on your person.
Yeah, you think it's habitual, right?
Yeah.
For them, when they're done using it, they just stick it right back on the belt.
It's like
there.
Your phone almost.
Right, and the phasers, same way.
Yeah.
Like when I'm done with my phone, it goes right back in my pocket. Rarely do I ever put it down on something unless I'm sitting somewhere. Then when I get up, I put it right back in my pocket. Yeah.
That might even be why in Next Generation they've developed a communicator that you wear as your insignia and you just tap it.
Interesting shot here too, by the way, as you see McCoy's shirt is unzipped at the collar.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Neat, huh?
Uh-huh.
You usually don't see stuff like that.
Yeah, I didn't even realize that those shirts...
They have zippers on the shoulders.
Yeah, I guess because they were kind of tight.
Good question.
Yeah.
Showing my lack of knowledge of the costumes, of course, but yeah. So McCoy had his unzipped there on the collar.
Mm-hmm. I gotta say, you had to be in pretty good shape to wear the Starfleet issued uniform.
Oh, you ain't kidding. There were no large people on the Enterprise.
Yeah.
And there's that toaster again. Oh, yeah. See, tempers are starting to flare as this disease sets in, madness.
Yeah. Well, McCoy's a doctor, so I think he understands more than anybody that in addition to dealing with this virus that's affecting him, he also has to keep his mind sharp and clear and figure things out.
Yep.
Find a cure or else they're done. I mean, at this point, they've learned that they have, I think, 5 days.
Something of that,
and then it transitions to 3 days. So there's a lot of time. Yep. For all the talking in this episode, there's at least 2 days where we don't see what they did.
Dialogue. Actually, a good point. Good point. So there's lapses in time here.
Yeah.
So here's a scene, you know, where we're supposed to be seeing some more relationship building here between Kirk and Janice Rand. Mm-hmm. As she's now noticed that she also has the disease, and it's affecting her quite heavily. Mm-hmm. She's kind of sad.
Yeah, and you get Miri sort of eavesdropping.
Yeah.
And one of the sort of through lines through this episode was that Miri was at the stage in her development as a human.
Young
where
lady,
She was entering the, you know, adulthood. So she's obviously
got a little thing
attracted to Kirk, or, you know,
well, who isn't?
Yeah. So there's, you know, a little tinge of jealousy here, which basically sends her away from the group of adults to the group of children who are planning this sort of, you know, how they can get rid of the adults.
Yeah. Well, I think the kids realize that you have some capable adults here who have the potential to do some damage to these kids should they reach the final stage of the disease. So,
well, yeah, I mean, these kids are living, they've lived through that already. I mean, you can only imagine the horrors that they saw.
Yep.
You know, over the course of their lives. And the idea of sort of a perpetual state of adolescence is an interesting one as well, because, you know, it's established that these kids are 300 years old, and you wonder what your mental development would be like if you were sort of developing at such a slow rate, but gaining so much experience that, you know, it had to be sort of interesting, because you're gaining experience and you learn from experience, but with an adolescent mind, you're not really able to process things
and
the way you
develop.
Do as an adult. Yeah. So it's interesting that that Kim Darby and sort of Michael Pollard here sort of played it full on like kids.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't really show that, you know, the hint that they had sort of earned their years or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing is, you know, it really just shows that they're afraid of adults.
Yep.
You know, that's pretty much, you know, their biggest problem. And you also have to wonder how many kids have reached maturity. We see two in this episode alone that are in monster mode. So,
well, stands to reason that there are plenty more all over the planet.
Oh, so you think they're this isn't like an isolated group?
No, I don't think so. I wouldn't think so. I mean, it truly is a duplicate of Earth. There should be people everywhere.
Mm-hmm. So, but the question is, where was the virus developed? And if it was developed just here, unless an adult who was infected traveled through and brought it back with them to, let's say, France, is there an alternate version of France just on that planet?
You know, it's a good thought. My opinion, the way I thought about it was that maybe. I guess they're in the North American continent somewhere mm-hmm. in this episode, right? But I'm going to assume that the madness would spread the same way that, say, the zombie apocalypse mm-hmm. would. So, you know, I don't think that, because you don't die immediately, you go crazy for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure that a lot of the adults who are in the original group probably ran off mm-hmm. somewhere else and wound up encountering other people and mm-hmm. then therefore spreading it around. I don't know how it or if it worked in other countries.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we'll never know the answer to that. I don't know if this serum was shipped out, or we also don't know how long, you know, really it was before they realized how dangerous it was. Mm-hmm. I mean, were they injecting themselves with this stuff for a while before they realized?
Mm-hmm.
Or...
Yeah, the only thing we do know is that this was ground zero for the development of the serum,
mm-hmm.
Which is also interesting because it seems like a lab space in the middle of what could be any town USA.
Yeah, not decidedly high tech.
Yes. So now Kirk is really trying to really get to Miri here and say, hey, you got to help us get our communicators back. And he's trying to convince her, and this is where sort of the child, the adolescent thinking comes into play. He says to her, hey, listen, you're going to get older eventually, and you're going to change, and you're going to turn into a monster just like we are.
Yep.
We're your last chance. If you don't let us figure this out, this is your future.
Sure. Yep.
And she, you know, in her childlike mind, denies it and says it doesn't happen to everybody.
Yeah.
You know, which is kind of also sort of like the, you know, how a lot of people deal with zombies in the zombie apocalypse movies, you know. I think, you know, movies that deal with viruses and the spread of viruses are really, really interesting because you see, you know, how people react to, you know, sick people when they're not infected yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of times that's when you really get a lot of potential for, you know, some great human interaction and people that hide it, especially in those zombie movies, you know, they get bitten or whatever. And then they say, oh, I'll hide it. I'll somehow fight the onset.
Yeah, they don't want to accept it, right?
Yeah.
They don't want to accept it. So, you know, one thing that I'll say about this episode that I find thought provoking is that, you know, we have this superior medical technology, right, on the ship. You know, you've seen McCoy already in a past episode come up with a solution to an unknown infectious disease mm-hmm. on the fly.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, the potential is there for them to do some pretty cool, you know, on-the-fly medical stuff. But despite that, there still seems to be this concern, this impetus that they're not going to be able to pull it off in mm-hmm. this episode.
Yeah.
So it makes you think that, you know, they have this great technology, but it's not perfect. It's still fallible.
Mm-hmm.
So even in the 23rd century, we're much further advanced medically. I mean, they can cure broken bones almost instantly. You know, come up with all kinds of crazy cures on the fly, but they still have a ways to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of interesting. So, you know, because you're introducing a superior technology, but as a plot device, it mm-hmm. still has to be fallible, or else these types of storylines won't work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bonk, bonk. Bonk, bonk on the head.
So, yeah, the kids pretty much want to just eliminate the adult threat and get on with playtime.
Some interesting chalk drawings on the board back there.
Yeah.
A girl with a triangular hat
mm-hmm.
And look at that. Is that an airplane crashing and a rocket ship taking off?
Yeah, it looks like it. I wonder if that was done by the production, the art department, or if they just let the kids have a go at the chalkboard for on break or before they started filming.
Well, what are the implications of what we're seeing back there? So there were airplanes in this on this planet. There were rocket ships potentially. And what's the figure with the triangular shaped hat on its head?
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
So this is this cracked me up. One of the kids rushes Kirk and tries to hit him with the club.
Wow.
I loved how quickly Kirk dismissed him because Kirk could infinitely handle an onslaught of these kids. So I like that they didn't, you know, show that these kids were any kind of physical threat to him. Sure, they pile onto him later, but he quickly breaks through it. But I really like the idea here because, you know, I'm sorry, no second grader is going to be able to really do anything of physical threat to, to Kirk, even with a non-projectile weapon.
Yeah, and you know, and obviously he's not able to rationalize what's going on to and these children.
Yeah.
So that would be the expected outcome anyway.
Yeah, and we're getting close to the moment where Kirk's going to pick this kid up and throw him down and... it's the kid with the flamboyant shirt hitting him with the wrench, and
bonk bonk,
yeah. And this is kind of cool. As he's getting beat down, you know, they cut away to the little girl just sitting there smiling.
Was that his own daughter? Was that his daughter?
It might have been. I'm not 100% sure.
It would be quite ironic if it was his daughter.
Yes.
Watching her father get beat down. Look at the blood.
Yeah.
And he might have some sort of internal head injury with that blood come out of his ear.
Kid was hitting him with a wrench. And here...
he ripped the shirt open.
Yeah, he's getting pretty theatrical here, you know. And these kids just don't realize what's on the horizon.
Yeah, they don't know. Look at this.
Who knows? That might be a Shatner girl. I love the fact that the kids here were like racially...
diverse.
You have you know, you have black kids, you have white kids, you have Asian kids.
You have kids with football helmets.
Yeah.
Which ill-fitting football helmets.
Yeah, they're definitely not really protecting against anything.
Nope. And here we go.
Miri shows.
Bonk, bonk. I think that's really one of the worst things in this episode, to be honest. It bugs me.
Yeah, and here comes the stunt performance.
Toss him. Yeah, whoa, I mean, right on the floor, man. You can't do that today.
And he holds him by the wrist, too. Yeah, I mean, he could have dislocated that kid's arm.
Yeah, you can't do that kind of stuff today.
Yeah.
It just goes to show you how different things were in the 60s.
Yeah.
You know, even when I grew up in the 70s, things were a lot different than they are today.
Oh, yeah. Little league coaches were, like, hitting their players.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Some things were better and some things were worse.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I remember you still got in trouble for back talking your teachers, and I remember if I in the movie theater if I talked or made noise and bothered other people, I got in trouble for that.
Mm-hmm.
My mom didn't stand for that stuff.
Yeah,
big difference. But anyway,
so they've developed what they think is a working serum, but they cannot confirm whether it is a correct. I guess viable cure
without
the ship's computer. So
yeah,
anybody who would be injecting this would be taking a huge risk.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of neat to see sort of Spock and McCoy argue about it because Spock is sort of immune to it.
Yep.
So he doesn't have he's a Vulcan anyway. It wouldn't matter to him, but he's not showing any kind of, you know, urgency. Whereas McCoy's like, hey man, I'm close to, you know, to going full monster here.
Yeah, this speaks quite a bit about McCoy's character.
He's convinced that his solution or his cure works. He doesn't be the computers,
and he doesn't have probably doesn't have enough time to develop another one. So you might as well take a shot.
Yeah.
You know, you might as well take a shot because he isn't going to last much longer the way he is.
Mm-hmm. And it looks like, based on his reaction, the cure does not work.
Doesn't look good.
No.
Down he goes.
And there's one of our red shirts that survived the episode.
And in comes Spock and finds out he injected himself. Yep. But as we come to find out,
he is okay.
This is kind of a neat effect, though. They do show, I believe they do show the scabs disappearing.
Yeah, once Kirk comes in and sort of tilts his head to the side, you see what you know was a really good effect for the time. You know, you have this time lapse sort of dissolve of the blue,
yep,
the blue rash on his cheek.
Pretty neat stuff.
Mm-hmm. So pretty much with the cure established, everything for the most part a-okay, I guess we can start wrapping up our discussion of this episode and talk about whether this is an essential episode for Star Trek viewers. I'll take the lead here.
Go for it.
And I'll come right out and say I don't think there's anything in this episode that makes it essential.
No.
It's not the strongest of episodes of the first season. And coming on the tail or you know, following up what Are Little Girls Made Of, which is an incredibly strong episode.
Mm-hmm.
This episode really kind of falls flat. So if somebody's looking to watch this series and just looking for the real essential stuff, I really can't find anything here that makes this essential.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to agree with you on that. So you don't really get a lot of character development on the part of the major players, with the exception of McCoy going off the deep end and injecting himself.
Mm-hmm.
But you'll see stuff like that in other episodes. So you won't lose any McCoy knowledge by not seeing that. So the only real development stuff you do see in this episode is more of the Rand and Kirk relationship, which becomes moot anyway.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's really no point in getting invested in that, since it gets tossed out very shortly after this anyway. The plot itself with the infectious disease is similar to a couple of other episodes. So, you know, you're not going to miss that concept. You know, the overall theme, though, of, you know, man essentially killing himself via science or biocontagion, it's a good message. But, you know, I think that, you know, in real life, we've probably all talked about that at some point. So we don't need Star Trek to tell us about it. And I'll say it one more time. The kids are annoying. that caps it off for me. Not an essential episode by any stretch.
Mm-hmm.
For me.
And we do learn that that they're going to report the planet to, I guess, Starfleet, and they're going to send out adults to take care of the children. Either
That's
I guess
nice, though.
Either off planet or on planet, I guess. And once they're vaccinated, there won't be any issues. But I guess there's, just like anything else, there's people willing to do that job, relocating to an alternate Earth that's in the 1960s, and you know, being guardians to some kids that have been living on their own for the last couple hundred years.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, you'd have to pay me a hell of a lot of quatloos to do that.
So, yeah, that brings us to the end of another episode. And as always, thank you for listening. And we will join you this time next week for another episode of the Tricorder Transmissions.
All right, guys. Thanks a lot for listening in. And don't forget to check out our website, tricordertransmissions.com.